This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, June 24th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. Support for KUAF comes from the CICA Summer Music Festival, continuing today with the Music Festival Students' Recital at the Eureka Springs Odd. This performance begins at 4:30 p.m. More information is available at cicamusicfestival.org.
The June Arts Festival in Bentonville continues until Saturday, June 30th. This celebration includes public art installations, visual art shows, gallery walks, live music, culinary events, theater performances, hands-on kids' art programs, and more. Information is available on the web at downtownbentonville.org or by calling 254-0254.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, an insider's view on Syria. Jacqueline Froelich speaks with a journalist who has moved from Syria to Fayetteville. Plus, we have a preview of the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series with organizer Robert Ginsberg.
But first, earlier this week, I began a series on a farm-to-school project taking place in Fayetteville this summer. Over the coming weeks, I will talk with kids, tag along on field trips, and shadow a cafeteria manager. My first report provides an introduction into this program. The benefits of farm-to-school are numerous, ranging from better foods and food education for our school children to economic and sustainability issues. And the USDA has picked up on these benefits. According to their website, the 2008 Food Conservation and Energy Act, also called the Farm Bill, amended the National School Lunch Act to allow institutions receiving funds through the Child Nutrition Program to choose where their produce comes from. The initiative Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food was formed as part of that. Fayetteville was the first school district in Arkansas to enact a farm-to-school program, shortly followed by Farmington, where Adam Simmons once worked. He is now the director of child nutrition with Fayetteville Public Schools.
The need is just for local fresh products, you know, not burning up the highways with strawberries when we can buy strawberries right here. And another reason, I think, is to teach the kids seasonality a little bit. You know, we serve tomatoes year-round, but maybe we shouldn't be serving tomatoes year-round because they're really only good for about a month and a half in the summer. So we're slowly but surely trying to teach seasonality.
I think it serves several needs.
That's Heather Frederick with the University of Arkansas Horticulture Department. She says that there are also benefits to local growers.
Market diversification is an issue for a lot of local growers, and they can, you know, sell at the farmer's market, and there's a couple stores and restaurants that they can sell to locally, but, you know, there's always a need for market diversification. And so the school lunches can serve as you know, a market outlet for them. But then, you know, taking it to the kids and the classroom education part of it, it's teaching these kids, you know, about nutrition and, you know, the local, you know, agricultural scene.
A relationship was formed between Fayetteville Public Schools, FPS, and the U of A after a farm-to-school conference a few years back. The U of A wrote and was recently rewarded a grant from Southern SARE, Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, a program of the USDA. It will allow for a project that will bring together the FPS summer feeding program and local farmers. Though there have been farm-to-school programs at FPS in the past, Adam says this grant will allow them to do things differently.
Well, I think it helped us identify farmers that would be willing to do the program. The university was able to give them things that we couldn't give, such as educational opportunities. We gave them a market that doesn't go away. You know, we're always here. We serve pretty much a set amount of number of kids a day every week, about 50 weeks a year. No, probably about 48 weeks a year. So we don't go bankrupt. We pay our bills, and we need local food.
And they are trying to show farmers that volume and consistency are sometimes better than high price.
You know, and that's kind of what we're working towards. I think the range is the 40 to 45 cent range for a half a cup of fruit or vegetables. That's all I have. I mean, I cannot spend it. And that's on the high end. And so we're working with that range right now to try to convince the farmers that this is a a sustainable relationship that they can make.
Heather Frederick with the U of A says there was a lot of in-depth planning with the farmers, working with them ahead of time, ahead of the season, to really plan out what the schools will need, when they'll need it, and what the growers can provide.
Because the growing season, you have to plan for harvest. You have to plan ahead of time. So that's kind of how things have come along that way.
As a pilot, they chose the summer feeding program because it's one school without a ton of kids, though the 400 to 800 sounds large. Adam explains the USDA-funded Seamless Summer Program.
The theory behind it is they should never go without some sort of school meal the whole summer. And so as soon as we close down, we were down a week to do some maintenance. We open right back up for lunch and snack till about a week before school starts. And it's free to anyone 18 years and under, no registration, no paperwork involved.
Emphasizing a sense of community, there's another partnership with Feed Fayetteville, an organization that aims to create community food security. Their role in this program is to connect kids with lunch buddies once a week to talk with them about what is on their plate, as well as to spread the word to the community about farm to school. I met Adrienne Schoenfield with Feed Fayetteville while she was at Owl Creek talking with kids about the salad on their trays. She says that studies show that farm to school improves children's nutrition. They eat more fruits and vegetables. But she says there has to be an educational component.
And just getting kids to stop and think for a minute about what they're eating is the goal of farm to school. I think there are some studies that show that in a farm to school program, 90% of students would choose healthier option at the supermarket compared to 62% before. So after they've gone through the farm to school program, it brings an awareness to the children about their food choices.
Another partnership is with Appleseeds, a nonprofit nutritional education organization. Lucy Kagan is heading up field trips the kiddos will be taking throughout the summer. They'll be going to the Fayetteville Farmers Market and to some area farms.
And so the students will get to, you know, participate in some fun farm activities, actually see a farm and actually see where food is growing. And they'll get to meet their farmer and then hopefully taste some of the produce that they've got growing there that they'll be eating at lunch that same week. So it's a really great way for them to get kind of the whole picture. And we'll be partnering with that and hopefully doing some more short presentations before the kids eat lunch, just so they can, get the gist of local, what it is, and why it's different.
With over a third of Arkansas's children overweight, she says that kids, and a lot of us really, have lost touch with where our food comes from and how it impacts what we do and how we live.
It's really important for kids to see that, you know, vegetables grow in the ground and they don't come out of a box. And that, you know, chicken comes off of an animal and it doesn't come in a star-shaped nugget form. And to just get kids to start thinking about, you know, where it comes from and why that matters is so important. It just brings that realm of consciousness back to eating.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. Earlier this month, Cook Sewell Vaughn of Rogers hosted a seminar and a grand opening celebration. The school is introducing an integrated form of martial arts to Northwest Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Wajeda attended the event and has this report.
Last weekend, adults and children dressed in black martial arts uniforms stood in pairs on the red workout floor of Cook Sewell Vaughn of Rogers. The partners practice a combination of kicks and punches on each other as part of an afternoon seminar. The school hosted the seminar as part of its grand opening celebration. According to the World Cook Sewell Vaughn Association's website, Cook Sewell Vaughn is a systematic study of all of the traditional fighting arts, which together comprise the martial arts history of Korea. As a martial arts system, Cook Sewell Vaughn seeks to integrate and explore the entire spectrum of established Asian fighting arts and body conditioning techniques, as well as mental development and traditional weapons training. Inyuk Su, the founder, grandmaster, and president of the World Cook Sewell Vaughn Association, was on hand at Saturday's event.
But I enjoy it, Cook Sewell.
Yes, sir.
You too enjoy it, huh?
Yes, sir.
The Grandmaster has studied martial arts for more than 50 years. He received his first instruction from his grandfather, who was an instructor in the Korean royal court. Following his grandfather's death, Inyuk-se traveled throughout the Far East, seeking out and studying traditional aspects of martial arts.
Martial art, you know, usually 80-year-old looks like a 40-year-old. You know, how old are you? I'm 39. Next year, 239.
Actually, the Grandmaster is 73 years old and he still trains. Dressed in a gold uniform with purple trim, he delivered a speech about 7 rules for a long life. He was making a point to the students and even some parents who joined their children sitting at the feet of the Grandmaster that the exercise you can do while practicing Kuk-sul-wan can help you maintain a healthy lifestyle. Today, the organization has more than 1 million members enrolled in 800 schools in 27 different countries. The group's headquarters are located just outside of Houston, Texas. Barry Harmon is a Texas-based ninth-degree black belt who traveled to Rogers with the Grandmaster. He says for those who have trained in a different form of martial arts, the skills they learned may be helpful to them should they begin training in Kuk-sul.
There are certain things that are quite useful, and of course all the physical skills, the good conditioning, and some of the fundamentals transfer over easily enough. But regardless of what rank a person is in any martial art, they always start at white belt because we have a very specific curriculum. And that curriculum has been one of the things that has kept Kuk-sul, for lack of a better word, as a pure martial art and not watered down over the years. Because as any martial art goes from instructor to student and that student becomes instructor and it travels down the martial art generations, it can always change very easily, and usually does. But because we have a set curriculum, and that curriculum has been systemized and written out for us by Kuk-sainin, every single Kuk-sul-wan school must follow that curriculum. Otherwise, they won't be authorized to teach Kuk-sul.
The seminar involved participants from 6 different schools, including the Rogers Studio, which is owned by Eric Spivey. The fourth-degree black belt runs the studio along with his wife, Stephanie. Eric enjoyed martial arts movies as a kid and says he was exposed to a variety of styles while he was in the military.
When I got out of the military, I found the closest school. It just happened to be Taekwondo. So I drove 62 miles one way to get to a Taekwondo school. Not every day, but as often as I could. And I kept training and finally got my first degree black belt. And then kept training and I said, I want more. Not just kicking and punching, not just, you know, that part. I wanted more, so I actually started looking at some of the softer styles because Taekwondo is hard. I started looking at soft, so Tai Chi, Wing Chun, some of the Chinese arts. And then, okay, that was good. And I did that for a few years, and we ended up moving to Arkansas, and there were several different schools around, and I just happened to pick up from Flyer at a martial art supply shop in Little Rock, and they had all different kinds of school flyers there, and I said, Kuk-sul, I've never heard of that. And I walked into a Kuk-sul school, and they were doing the joint locks, and the throws, and acrobatics, and the weapons, and the falls, and the forms, and the kicks, and the punches, and I was like, that's what I've always wanted to do, right? So I found home. That was home for me, and that was 17 years ago. So when I walked into a school, matter of fact, my instructor, I was there for 10 years in Jacksonville training. Right. And he, over the years, showed me this is how you run a school. This is how you do things. This is how you grow, right? So my wife, who you met, Kyosunim, which is second degree, Stephanie Spivey, I was walking around the house just hitting things, and she's like, you need to go train. You need to go. Why don't you just open a school? That way you can do this. I was like, that's not a bad idea. What about that? So we decided to open a school.
The couple opened a school in February of 2006. They now have about 40 students ranging in age from 5 to 62 years old. When teaching something that incorporates a variety of techniques, organization is key.
That is one of the things that is the vision of our grandmaster. It's organized systematically so that when you learn this part, this builds on it. And this part builds on it, so that when you're doing these forms and learning certain hand movements and certain ways to do movements and hand strikes, that equates to the same thing you're going to do with a sword, So the muscle memory and skill sets are there. We just need to teach you the last little bit of using the actual weapon. So there's pieces of it, and it's very organized and systematic in how you learn the techniques and joint locks. Like he was talking about, there are 670 pressure points that we attack. There are 164 joints. There's anatomy and physiology involved in this too. So it's a very well-rounded martial art. And it's very organized so that, okay, at this belt level, white belt, you need to learn these things. Okay, fine. Now that you learn that, okay, yellow belt, you need to learn these things. And by the time you get to first degree, you've got all of that knowledge that we can say, okay, I can walk up to a student and say, this technique, do it this way, like that, in this angle. So they have that knowledge base. Oh, that's like Kibansu 3, you want me to do this? Yeah, they understand.
Eric and his wife moved the school to its current location on the corner of Pleasant Grove and Honeysuckle last October. Saturday marked the official grand opening, and Eric was pleased to have the Grand Master in attendance.
It is a great honor to have him come here, and then all of the knowledge of all the other masters that are traveling with him. So he has an entourage of a lot of different senior masters that travel with him as well. So yeah, and they're out there teaching. And it's great to have a master come up and say, oh, wait a minute, don't move your hand this way, move your hand this way, and here's why, that pressure point works that way. It's phenomenal.
I mean, because especially for you being the instructor, you're so used to being the one teaching, it's probably nice to have somebody teach you a little.
Yes. And that's important too, because I have to keep progressing. I have to keep training. I have to keep going. So somebody's got to teach me. As a matter of fact, a couple of my instructors are out there today, and yeah, so they're going to take me to the side and say, okay, fine, let's work on this part. Or sometimes I have to travel to them for my training. So as I progress, then my students can progress. So it's all about sharing, right? And Cooksville is very organized in that way, so that as you're going up through the ranks, they want to make sure that you're giving back to the beginners.
More information is available at Kook, that's K-U-K, Sewell, S-O-O-L, Juan, W-O-N, -Rogers.com.
I say stop! Sir! That's times four. I want times eight.
Sir!
One time push
up. Sir!
Go!
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, June 24th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. This is usually the time when Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers joins us in the studio with things to do today. But this week, she is in New Orleans. So on Friday, she spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums and Antoinette Grajeda. Here is that conversation.
Thank you, Ithi. It's not Sunday, actually, where we are. It's still Friday.
Yep.
Because Becca has left for New Orleans. But before you left for New Orleans, you recorded this with Antoinette and myself for Sunday.
Because it's a miracle. Just go with that.
Yay, technology.
That's
yay,
right.
Technology. But I will be here live Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to talk to you.
On the phone.
Yeah,
on
you'll
the
be
phone.
Live from New Orleans.
I'll be live from New Orleans to talk about what's going on there and what's going on here. What's going on here later this week is Art Night Out at Crystal Bridges. Mm-hmm. I believe there are people who have not yet been to Crystal Bridges.
I don't know who they... Well, yeah, I'm
I
sure there
people.
Are. Really? Okay.
Because we were there Sunday for Trout Fishing in America.
Oh.
And there were still way too many people wandering around looking lost. So I believe there are still people who haven't been. Art Night Out is a great time to go. And don't take the kids.
No. This is more for the older folk.
This one's called Journey into the Wild. It will include the Hudson River School Nature and the American Vision mm-hmm. Exhibition.
Three Penny Acre,
Still on the Hill. A group called Fork and Knife.
They're so much fun. We've mm-hmm. had them in Furman Garner. They're great.
And Mark Bilyeu.
Formerly Big Smith.
Mm-hmm. All Out Around the Love Sculpture mm-hmm. on the South Lawn. There will also be a painting demonstration, a flashlight tour on the Crystal Spring Trail. You can walk around the pond. You can see the Great Hall. There will be nature films. The Seedling Film Association will be there. There's a creative writing project with folks from the University of Arkansas. It sounds like a great time.
It's on Thursday night, correct?
7 to 10 on Thursday. Tickets are $15 for museum members and $20 for non-members. Now, if you're looking for things to do this afternoon in Northwest Arkansas, mm-hmm. Friends of the Rogers Historical Museum are meeting with Alan Lord coming to speak on Coin Harvey.
Oh.
If you share in the matinee obsession, 2 o'clock at the Rogers Historical Museum Annex. The Mountain Street Stage Music Series concludes.
All wrapped up after this.
R.J. Michaud and his Red Hot Blues Band, 2 to 4 at the Fayetteville Public Library. If that place is not bursting at the seams, really, why? Crafts on the Square at the Spark Cafe in Bentonville. Today's topic is Anything Can Be Art, Found Object Art, from 2 to 4. And Clayton Conversations at the Clayton House Museum in Fort Smith at 2:15. Architect Graham Sherem is going to talk about some of the architectural styles found in Fort Smith.
A lot of fun.
Thank you, Becca.
I would say see you guys, but I don't see you now. Bye.
That's right.
Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
The KUAF Summer Jazz Series begins this Saturday at Walton Arts Center Star Theater. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums spoke with KUAF's Shades of Jazz host and organizer of the series, Robert Ginsberg, about the acts we can expect to see this summer. Here is their conversation.
This is
next week,
Ozarks
Becca Martin Brown will join
with
us on the phone
Robert
from
Ginsberg,
New Orleans.
Who is the curator for the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society's Summer Jazz Concert Series, the 14th one.
That's right, Kyle. 14 years of summer jazz concerts. They used to be over in Stella Boyle Smith Fine Arts Concert Hall. For the last few years, we've moved over to the Walton Arts Center, and we've kind of snuggled up there. We like that venue. It's a great place for jazz.
This year, you have a pianist who's played with Joshua Redman and Wynton Marsalis. You have an Emmy Award-winning composer. You have a guitarist who's played all over the world and with the likes of Dizzy Gillespie and Sarah Vaughan.
Just 3 concerts, but it's a rich palette. Yeah, it's really a great season. And we're starting off with a bang, the one and only group that is a touring band, and this is Aaron Goldberg. Not exactly a household name. YouTube Aaron, and you will be blown away. He's played around the world. He's played with the likes of Betty Carter, great jazz vocalists. He's paid his dues. He's a young man in his 30s, amazing composer, and just a hard-driving modern jazz, post-bebop stylist.
Included in the release about the series is a quote that says he leads one of the most exciting trios in jazz. Is that hyperbole?
You know, it really isn't, because the trio format to begin with is such an exciting – you don't have that horn player that kind of exudes excitement, whether it's a saxophonist or a trumpet. So a trio has a different dynamic. It's a very stable musical triangle, but it also at its best is one of the most compelling dynamics to me, because the interplay is very on the surface, and the dynamics are so exciting because so much depends on the melodic center of the piano player. So when you have somebody like Gonzalo Rubalcaba, who was here once with his trio, which was another one of the trios of this caliber that is just thrilling.
Really? You're going to – because Gonzalo Rubalcaba was considered one of the greatest living jazz pianist, right?
Well, you know, he's one of those great Cuban piano players, and exciting in terms of his pyrotechnics. And
So the Aaron Goldberg Trio is on this level?
I would absolutely put him on that level, Kyle. It's great stuff, as you will hear.
Aaron Goldberg Trio will begin this summer series, and that's on June 30th.
June 30th. They're all Saturday nights. They're all at Star Theater, and tickets are available online, on the phone. Jazz Society members get a significant discount. So,
Could you join the Jazz Society right now and be eligible for that discount?
It's funny you should ask. Our newly reworked website is finally up and running, and it's digjazz.com, as in can you dig it, digjazz.com. All the info about the series with links to the artists and how to become a member of the Jazz Society is there. And we're a non-prof. The financial basis is membership and concert sales, and the whole Summer Jazz Concert Series really sponsors our student scholarship program. So it's you save $5 per ticket if you are a member of the Jazz Society, and that alone would just about pay for an individual membership.
The Composer Showcase is in the middle of this year's festival. That's July 28th, and it's a little bit different this year.
It is. The Composer Showcase was kind of our tip of the hat, the Jazz Society and KUAF's tip of the hat to our regional composers and performers. We wanted to give these regional guys a showcase where there wasn't a TV set behind them and people serving drinks in mm-hmm. front of them, and put them on stage. And also put them on stage playing original compositions, not just doing standards and covers. And it's been very successful. We decided this year, instead of having a palette of different composers and different ensembles, we'll still have a palette of different ensembles, which will definitely include the 18-piece Fayetteville Jazz Collective Big Band, Claudia Burson's Trio, Jim Greason's Hogtown Hot Club, Ooh. Gypsy Swing Band, and several more to be announced. But instead of a bunch of different composers, every one of these groups is going to interpret the works of one composer, and that's Dr. Jim Greason from the university.
He's the Emmy winner that I referred to when we began this conversation. He won for a soundtrack that he created for The Buffalo Flows. And he has been writing and playing
forever, since we were in junior high school together in St. Louis. Jim and I grew up together.
I did not know you were in junior high school together.
Yeah, I thought I told you this story. Many years ago in the 80s, early 80s, when Jim first moved here, I didn't know he had moved here. I was walking up around the square, and I saw at Hugo's there was some live music downstairs, and said, Jim Greason. And I went, that can't be the Jim Greason I went to school with. And sure enough, it was. So Jim is an outstanding composer and guitarist and bassist. And he has quite a body of work. So it'll be interesting to hear Jim's music played by an 18-piece big band, by a trio, some gypsy jazz, and who knows what else it could be.
You call this a jazz variety show.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that sort of thing, where it's not just – I mean, if it's a great group, you can sit for hours and listen. But having that different dynamic of duos, trios, quintets, big band, it just adds to the evening to me. So knowing that the motif flowing through all of this, of course, will be the compositions of Jim Greason. So that's the Composer Showcase, Saturday, July 28th.
Then August 11th, another Saturday – Vic Juris. He's the guitarist I mentioned who's played with Sarah Vaughan and Dizzy Gillespie.
Dizzy Gillespie. Vic Juris is absolutely a chameleon, Kyle. He can play bossa nova. He's been here before with Nilson Mata's Brazilian Voyage. He's played the Artisphere Festival. He's a great samba player. He's self-taught. He grew up
Big Chuck Berry fan
as a kid. Yeah, that's what kind of inspired him to play the guitar. And then he moved into jazz, but he can play all styles, totally modern stuff, Ornette Coleman type stuff, bebop, gorgeous ballads. He really has an eclectic taste in music. And one of the things about Vic, I'm going to say, is in his late 50s, right near at 60. He's almost my age. And he is at that point in his career where he's so good, he doesn't have to prove it to anybody. He is not about flash and pyrotechnics, although he can go there anytime he wants. But if he does, it's for a good reason. It's not just to show off. He's confident in his playing, and he's one of these guys that really has something to say, and a very generous player. He gives his sidemen a lot of room. His compositions are fantastic as well. And he's also one of those musicians who I find the most desirable, who has a voice, and you can hear it in his playing.
DigJazz.com to find out the whole schedule and bios of all those involved.
Yes, and feel free to email me, info@digjazz.com. I'd love your feedback on what you want to hear and what you think of the site. And we'd love to see you at this summer's KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series.
There is cabaret seating, and there's then general admission. What's the capacity per concert?
It's
any idea?
Only about 150
people. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So
very intimate. And, you know, usually during the Walton Arts Center season, we do two shows, two 70-minute shows. This is going to be two sets with an intermission. We're not doing two shows, so our capacity is really
half
just that.
Yeah. Of what you're used to.
And what seems to be selling the quickest are the cabaret seats, but I wouldn't wait. And again, I'll mention, if you are a member of the Jazz Society, you'll save $5 a ticket.
All right. DigJazz.com. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Kyle.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. Syrian journalist and activist Omar al-Mughdad has been covering the Syrian revolution since it first began last March as part of the Arab Spring. Because his life is at risk, the U.S. State Department granted him political asylum. He moved to Fayetteville in early June. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with the self-described media smuggler.
In the winter of 2010, a Tunisian man immolates himself, triggering what would become the Arab Spring. Democracy movements blossom in Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Libya, and last March in Syria. Omar al-Mughdad was at ground zero when the first opposition protest was crushed in Deraa, his hometown in southwestern Syria, near the border of Jordan. With a degree in political science from Damascus University's Department of Foreign Affairs, he's been documenting President Bashar Assad's dictatorial rule for over a decade. He's been imprisoned repeatedly, once for 22 months. He's filed stories to CNN, ABC, NBC, and has been a source for Deborah Amos, who is covering the conflict for NPR from Damascus, the only American journalist allowed inside the country. But what Omar al-Mughdad is most proud of is that he launched Syria's first free press, espousing democratic rule and freedom for all Syrians.
So, first of all, this revolution what kind of people who start this revolution is the ordinary people. So, the people who all ethnics and religious. It's a revolution, a peaceful revolution for freedom.
At stake is the Assad regime in power for more than four decades, operating under the Ba'ath Party, the same party which supported Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The authoritarian government operates in secret and relies on informants to quickly crush dissent. Assad's government is allied with Hezbollah in Lebanon, which seeks the destruction of Israel. Allied with Assad are the Alawites, Shia Islamists, whom Assad's forces have agitated against Sunni, Kurds, and Christians. But Omar al-Mughdad said he and his colleagues simply seek sectarian-free democratic rule.
All the ethnics, they are part of this revolution. So the sectarian war, the sectarian things is the regime game.
And Omar's religious identity?
I like this statement. In fact, I believe in love, whatever, in church or mosque or temple, wherever and whenever. I don't care. That's who I am. I remember that I was praying. I lived in Babtuma. It's a neighborhood in Damascus. I used to open my door in the morning. My door, it was in front of church door. And I was going and holding the sermon. And the people think that I'm Christian all the time, and they don't know that. Go and burn a candle, and then I go to mosque. The same thing. This house of God, I can feel the love and feel the God everywhere.
It was Providence that saved Omar's life after Assad's militia came after him one final time.
The security forces start attacking, and my house start arresting the people around me, my friends. They want to know where is Omar now. I used to hide on the border for 15 days in a cave before I leave. Then I escaped the to Turkey. When I got the guys say it's risky to stay here. The guys are know about you, the security forces, and you must leave the country. I left to Turkey, but I continue smuggling with the media inside the country, but illegal. We go in and back.
Omar al-Mughdad traveled from the Turkish refugee camp, arriving in New York City on June 4th, before settling in Fayetteville. St. Joseph's Catholic Church is financing his stay. He lives in a rent-free apartment. Compliments of local contractor Fadil Bayari. Local Catholic Charities immigration agents are assisting with necessary paperwork. So what is it like to be safe in America while the revolution rages back home?
In fact, it's really sometimes like a dream or like a nightmare. Because a couple of weeks ago, I was in Syria. They say you fly the 4th of June to the United States. You have to prepare yourself. And I felt that's like to say goodbye for the country, as I feel to say. But no, I will continue doing my job because the digital world is, you can do that wherever. I have the contacts. I have all the networks inside the country. I can get the videos and upload it. I'd reach the people to the internet and reach the people's voices out of the country and talk to the people that's there are people here in this country, in Middle East, who loves the freedom exactly how you love. And they are not as the media show them.
Like his nation, even Omar al-Mukhtad's family is divided. He's pro-democracy, but has family serving in Assad's regime.
Yeah, Faisal al-Mukhtad. He was the representative, represents Syria in the United Nations in New York. And now he's the second guy in the Foreign Office. Yeah, and he's one of the Assad alliance. He is something different from me, and we have all the time problems with each other.
He left behind a mother and a brother. He has no idea if or when he will see them again.
I called my mother when I arrived here from USA, and she seems tired.
Media reports cite 5,000 Syrians have been killed by Assad's forces, some in mass slaughters. But Omar says the numbers are much higher.
It's more than 15,000. Forget about what the statistic telling you. That's what we know, the 15,000 victims and almost 200 exiles, 200,000 exiles. And in the ground also there is villages it's empty now. They turn the villages to the ghost towns, to the ghost cities, like Dera, like Baba Amru neighborhood in Homs, in Hama. There's a lot of places. It's like a raging bull now, attacking everything could move on the ground.
Eyewitness reports account gory assaults by the Syrian army on innocent Syrians in an effort to frighten the population into submission, fueling even more opposition. Omar would have suffered a horrific fate had he not escaped into southern Turkey to where an estimated 30,000 other Syrian refugees have fled. Last week, it was widely reported that the U.S. State Department claimed Russia, a Syrian ally and longtime client state, was providing weapons, including attack helicopters, to Assad's army. A Russian diplomat denied the claim, while at the same time, Russia's chief arms exporter said it was shipping missile defense systems to Syria. The White House has called for President Assad to step down, but refuses to arm Syrian rebels to avoid conflicts with both Iran and Russia. In mid-May, the State Department did release $40 million to assist relief organizations.
At least minimum what they can do to help the people if they don't want to engage in a conflict on the ground against the regime, because they have problems in Iraq. They have problems in Afghanistan. They are trying to solve these problems first before they engage in other places.
Omar al-Mukhtad continues to report on events in his homeland, including via Twitter, brutal images of murdered children and pets.
You got to do what you got to do. That's very important. We have to show the world what's happening there.
And while most of us have become numb to decades of violence in the Middle East, Omar says, as a global community, we all need to stand up and support.
Each person who considers himself that he's part of a humanity, he has to care. I don't believe there's people, why I must care?
Omar says the only way Assad's rule will end is for the international community to apply intense political pressure. A peace plan in Syria was to have been implemented last April, orchestrated by UN Special Envoy on Syria, Kofi Annan. Instead, the violence spirals out of control. The United Nations Security Council had considered intervention by sending in UN troops, but there is no consensus. The Russian Federation and China both refuse, simply saying the conflict is an internal matter. As for Omar al-Mukhtad, he has no idea if and when he'll be able to return home. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A forum on Syria featuring Omar al-Mughdad will be hosted by St. Joseph's Catholic Church at 1722 North Star Drive in Fayetteville today from 6:30 to 8 p.m. For details, 422-7887. This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
And Christina, you had something really interesting to tell us about last week.
Yes. I went to a shooting range.
That is shooting range exciting.
Right.
But what?
This is a different kind of shooting range.
Right.
These guys dress up like cowboys. And so they have Old West shootouts.
That is amazing.
Yesterday, they were at the Siloam Springs Heritage Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then today happens to be the fourth Sunday of the month.
Okay.
And every second Saturday and fourth Sunday,
right.
The Arkansas Leadslingers have shootouts at their range. So,
and did you get to shoot?
I did. I did. It was so much fun. I shot a pistol, a rifle, and a shotgun.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let's listen to that story first.
Here it is.
Well, welcome to Frisco City.
That's Jim Starnes, food broker being his real-life occupation. But today, he's Ozarks Jim, banker and mayor of Frisco City.
This is our little place in the woods where we come out and enjoy the fastest-growing sport in the United States in shooting, and that's cowboy action shooting.
Ozarks Jim is dressed in old-timey Western gear, complete with a bolo, arm garter, and, of course, a cowboy hat. But he and members of his group, Arkansas Leadslingers, are not reenactors. This is a sport, one sanctioned by the Single Action Shooting Society and the National Rifle Association.
We use real guns, real ammo, shooting at real targets. You're underneath the clock. So it's all about speed and accuracy. You can go real fast, but if you miss, that doesn't help much.
Frisco City provides the place for the Slingers to compete, which they do the second Saturday and fourth Sunday of every month. It's a narrow plot of land nestled in a valley near Lost Bridge. And, like Ozarks Jim, its name, or handle, is related to the Old West.
The landowner here, who is the president of our company, is Dirty Dan Paladin. And if you remember the old Paladin movies, Have Gun, Will Travel, what that is all based on is in Frisco City. So that's why we call this Frisco City. In fact, right now we're standing in the Hotel Carlton, which was the headquarters of Paladin, a traveling gunfighter. And so that's the persona or alias that he took on. So that's why we named our city Frisco City.
There are 20 to 30 shooters during a typical event, ranging from very old to just over 8. They separate into two posses, moving into the buildings, which are built by members of this group. There are about 10 or so, lined up on either side of Main Street, serving as stages for the shooting scenarios. They face into the woods, where metal targets are strategically placed.
One of the things we normally incorporate in the scenario is a little story. Whether it's something about history, whether it's something fun, a lot of times we'll use old Western movies, TV shows, things like that. And then that'll kind of set the stage for what you're getting ready to do. Then, of course, also in the scenario is the shooting order, how much ammo you're going to need for each stage, what order you shoot your guns in, what targets you shoot at. So that's read right before the start of each stage, so every posse member hears that once. Then it's up to them to figure out, okay, how am I going to do this the fastest, the most accurate, and of course the safest.
He mentioned safety, and safety is important to the Slingers. Each posse has an unloading and loading officer, 3 spotters, a timer operator, and brass picker-uppers. This is a 3-gun sport, 4 really, because they use 2 pistols, but it's 3 types: a pistol, rifle, and shotgun.
Gun has to be patented before 1897. The gun could have been made last Thursday. Not too many people would want to come out and shoot a gun made in 1897, especially as much as we shoot. So most of the guns that we're using are replicas, but they are the real thing. You can load them with high power loads. A lot of our guys will use their, like their rifles, they'll use them for deer hunting or anything else. Our 6 guns, most of the guys shoot either 38s or 357s.
The guns are single action. In 1897, they didn't have automatics or semi-automatics, so everything is done one cock, one shot. As the name of their group would indicate, they use lead bullets, which, when you're shooting up to 200 each shoot, can get expensive.
Now, we do most of the shots will hit the targets, and that allows us to recycle all of the lead that we use. We come out and we pick up all the lead, we remelt it down and make new bullets out of it. So we're not putting the lead back into the environment. We're keeping it out.
The guns are single action. In 1897, they didn't have automatics or semi-automatics, so everything is done one cock, one shot.
Which means you have to pull the trigger back and click it. You do that each time. Like that.
As the name of their group would indicate, they use lead bullets, which, when you're shooting up to 200 each shoot, can get expensive.
Most of the shots will hit the targets, and that allows us to recycle all of the lead that we use. We come out and we pick up all the lead, we remelt it down and make new bullets out of it. So we're not putting the lead back into the environment. We're keeping it out.
Economical and environmentally friendly. As he mentioned before, Ozark's Jim and I are in the Hotel Carlton. He gives us a scenario for a shoot there.
Hey, you know, you've gotten in from the trail. You come in to get a room and find out the last room's been sold. So you're going to have a gunfight with somebody here to get a room to sleep in that night.
In the scenario, they will tell you which type of gun to start with and the one to use second and third, plus the order of the sweeps.
So it's kind of a mental game in that, first of all, you have to remember the right order of shooting your guns. You have to shoot the targets in the right order. And, of course, you have to hit the targets.
Ozark's Jim prepares to shoot his targets, loading his guns carefully, putting on eye and ear protection, and setting the timer.
That's my room!
Simulating an old Western gunfight, the targets are close, between 15 and 20 yards away. Because in a street fight, that's how far your opponent would have been. Ozark's Jim makes a sweep with one of his six-shooter pistols, then pulls another from its holster on his hip and makes his second sweep. Next is the rifle, which he shoots at a row of targets a bit further back. Lastly is the shotgun, which he aims at knockdown targets. When you shoot at him, they fall down.
And I did that in 31.5 seconds, which is not good. I had a couple of fumbles there. You saw there was a few places where I lost some time. I'm pretty sure I hit all of them, but I couldn't tell for sure.
The world record is just over 13 seconds. Though I wasn't exactly in the cowboy spirit, I'd left my hat at home. Jim let me try my hand at shooting.
That's my room.
Stand by. Fire! That's it.
Well,
you had
four out of five,
and the four that you hit were right square in the middle.
Yay!
You done good. You're ready to move up to the rifle now.
The rifle? It was my favorite.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 24th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of the playwright George Shields, born near Ballymoney in County Antrim, Ireland, 1881. Came to North America when he was a young man. He worked on the Canadian Pacific Railroad, had an accident which left him confined to a wheelchair, went back to Ireland, opened a shipping company with his brother, and he started writing poems and stories and then plays. Starting in 1921 with a play entitled Bedmates, it was produced at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin. It's the birthday of the Argentine novelist Ernesto Sabato, born in Buenos Aires, 1911. His parents were Italian immigrants. Sabato embarked on a career in physics, worked in atomic radiation labs, quit because he was disillusioned with the way he saw the new discoveries being used, became a writer, wrote three novels, The Tunnel, On Heroes and Tombs, and The Angel of Darkness. He was diagnosed with lesions on his retinas in the 70s. Doctors told him to give up reading and writing. But still, at the request of the president of Argentina, Raul Alfonsín, Sabato compiled a record of atrocities committed during the country's seven-year military dictatorship, a 50,000-page document called Never Again, which contained evidence of at least 9,000 people who had been disappeared under the dictatorship. He died last year, less than 2 months before his 100th birthday. It's the birthday of St. John of the Cross, born in Fontevero, Spain, 1542, who, along with St. Teresa of Avila, reformed the Carmelite order. He was arrested for his attempts at reform. He was given a public lashing once a week, put in jail, where he wrote his most beautiful poetry. St. John of the Cross, who wrote, "If a man wants to be sure of the road he treads on, he must close his eyes and walk in the dark." It's the birthday of Ambrose Bierce, born near Horse Cave Creek, Ohio, 1842, best known for his short stories An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and also for The Devil's Dictionary. Served in the Civil War, fought in some of the bloodiest battles, and wrote stories about the war that were bleak and bitter and had no heroes. And it's the birthday of the novelist Anita Desai, born north of Delhi in India, 1937. Her mother was German, her father was Bengali. Grew up speaking German at home, Hindi with her friends, learned Bengali from her father, listened to Urdu poetry in the streets. But in school, she learned to read and to write in English. And she wrote her novels in that language. Cry the Peacock was the first. Most recently, a collection of three novellas, The Artist of Disappearance. Here's a poem for today by Ted Kooser, Highway 30. At 2 a.m, when the moon has driven away, leaving the faint taillight of one star at the horizon, a light like moonlight leaks from broken crates that lie fallen along the highway, becoming motels, all-night cafes, and bus stations with greenhouse windows, where lone women sit like overturned flower pots, crushing the soft gray petals of old coats. Highway 30 by Ted Kooser. From Sure Signs, New and Selected Poems, published by University of Pittsburgh Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The 14th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series welcomes jazz pianist Aaron Goldberg and trio to Walton Arts Center Star Theater this Saturday, June 30th at 8. This New York City pianist and composer has spent the last 12 years touring with the likes of Wynton Marsalis and others. Tickets, including limited cabaret seating, available by calling 443-5600 or on the web, waltonartscenter.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madholkar.
And I'm Christina Thomas.